You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. And it is gorgeous out. You know, Don, they said it was going to be over 90, but I don't think it made it last week.
We have not broken 90 degrees in over a week, which is, I know there's parts of the country where 90 degrees would be a heat wave. 90 degrees here is pretty close to our average temperature as we get into June, July, August, September. We are going up to a high today, as Lois and I record this on June 11th to be broadcast on June 12th, going up to a high today of 86 degrees with a low temperature tonight of 52. Last night it was 51 degrees. Felt kind of chilly here. I believe we're going to break 90 degrees the day of the broadcast because the National Weather Service says Davis is going to get to 91 on Thursday. Thursday night, 55. Friday, 88. Friday night, 52. Saturday, 86. Listen to these temperatures. 86 degrees on Saturday, mostly sunny. Partly cloudy Saturday night, 53 degrees. Sunday looks like it might be 90 degrees again. And we are going to warm up next week, apparently. Sunday night will be 55. Monday, 91. Monday night, 58. Tuesday, 96. Weather Underground is telling us that it's going to be, let's see, 100 degrees on Tuesday and 100 degrees on Wednesday, and then back down into the mid-90s Thursday and Friday of next week. We've just gone through 7 to 10 days of very balmy, cool, pleasant weather by our standards. Average high temperature this time of year actually for this date would be 87 degrees, but it's not uncommon at all for us to be over 90, and it's not uncommon at all for us to be up around 100 degrees as we get through late June, July, August. We have a couple dozen days over 100 typically here in the Sacramento Valley, at least our part of the Sacramento Valley. So very pleasant weather, and guess what's really happening right now? Tomatoes are setting like crazy. This is tomato self-pollination weather, and it's going very, very well for most people. Tomatoes that you put in back in late April or through May should be setting very well with these kinds of temperatures. We're having a lot of conversations about watering problems and so forth. A gentleman came in, a brief digression here from our usual, wanting to know what was eating the flowers off of his tomato plants, because he'd go out in the morning and there'd be flowers and he'd come back at the end of the day and they were gone. And what that is they didn't pollinate. And it wasn't a problem in his case with temperature. Certainly wasn't a problem with anything eating them. He was running his drip system 3 times a week for 5 minutes.
Poor and little plants. They were just starving.
Yeah, they were drought stressed. So this is a good time of year to really deep water your vegetable garden. So those roots will get down and they'll set really well and you'll have good crop production later. You know, we talk about that a lot. So we'll just move on from that. But that particular one, 3 times a week, 5 minutes with a drip system, that's not going to do it. You need to run a little bit longer than that.
A little bit.
We have to work up to that with some folks, because I don't know where this is coming from, where people are setting their drip systems to run for 5 minutes, 10 minutes. You know, we can say 0.4 gallons per hour output. That's like less than a coffee cup of water 3 times a week. Less than a coffee cup of water seems to be a pretty good visual for a lot of folks. And then we can move from there onto how long you actually need to water. It'd be a good time right now to go out and give everything a really deep soaking. Plants are growing well. This is an important time for them to be pollinating and setting fruit. You've heard this before, so we'll just move on. The weather looks great for the coming week. We'll be hot again. We'll be dry again. And we'll start this process of going into the 90s and down into the 80s and sometimes over 100. And the night temperatures will be in the 50s or possibly low 60s. That's pretty typical summer weather here. And the humidity will be very low in the middle of the afternoon, which is one of the things we're actually kind of grateful for here because it solves a lot of disease and pest problems.
Coming up, we have the Davis Music Festival Fest, excuse me, Davis Music Fest.
Yes.
And it is going to be a whole bunch of people playing a lot of different things and lots of different venues. And KDRT broadcasts live. It streams from the Music Fest. Don, when is the actual Davis Music Fest and how can folks find out more about it?
Well, it is June 20 through 22. There's ticket information at davismusicfest.com. And they are sponsoring or underwriting several hours of programming at KDRT. So you're going to hear this periodically. I'll go ahead and do one for you. This hour of KDRT programming is underwritten by the Davis Live Music Collective, presenting the 2025 Davis Music Festival, featuring, in this particular case that was put in front of me, Milk for the Angry, Object Heavy, The Big Poppies, I like that one, and 35 more artists performing across seven Davis venues, June 20 through 22. And again, ticket information, davismusicfest.com. We have an announcement.
This person
here at KDRT does a show called That's Life. And this particular program recently was an interview with some guy named Don Shore. And this was from 2021, I believe. And it's all about soil and water and weather and things like that. I don't remember doing this show, but I'm sure it's great.
It's a great show. This was in 2022. Okay. And everybody was home. We were all just, you know, sequestered. And Don and I got on and he talked about why our landscape is like it is. What I mean is, like, we're in the Central Valley of California. Well, why is it like it is? Mm-hmm. And what happens? Where do we get the water from? Where does it go? What are the soil types? It was fascinating. So if you missed it, tune in again, or better yet, go to kdrt.org and look for the program That's Life. That's my show. And you'll find it there. It's archived there. It'll be there forever.
Yeah, That's Life with California Water is the topic, and it's particularly relevant to folks living in the area, Davis, Dixon, Woodland. But if you're interested in where we're coming from when we're talking to you, I don't know, you're listening in Southern California or Canada or someplace, you'll understand a little bit better about what we are here. We're on a big floodplain with interesting soils as a consequence. So That's Life with California Water at kdrt.org. Okay, I also have a question for you.
Yes.
Do starlings take over the nests of flickers?
Yes.
Oh, that's very sad.
Well, yes or no? Okay, so let's be a little more specific than this.
Okay.
Flickers are here in the winter. In Davis, they come for the winter. They go someplace else to have their nesting sites. So a flicker would not have made a nest. Now, it might hang out at a nest in the winter, but we have other woodpeckers that nest and here. And so if there were an abandoned woodpecker nest, could be a hairy, a downy, a nuttles, a starling could take it in. Usually what starlings do is they inhabit a dead tree that has lots and lots of places to have holes, that has, because they're communal birds. Mm-hmm. They don't, it's not like one nest. Now, if you find starlings and they're nesting, it's going to be dozens.
Okay. Because I had what I thought was a flicker. I guess it's a woodpecker nesting in my attic year after year after year for the last several years. And don't they have spots on them? They're kind of, anyway, I don't know my birds that well. And I noticed a much quieter bird had taken over the nest this season. This was about a month or two ago. So late spring. They're not nearly as pleasant or fun to have around as the flickers and woodpeckers, but if it's taken over the nest or if it's moving in there, and that's going to be an ongoing thing and they're a communal type of thing, I'm going to screen over that hole. That was the reason I asked.
So I would recommend you screen over that hole. If the bird was here in the summer, it was definitely not a flicker. If it was here from fall to spring, could well have been a flicker.
Yeah. Okay.
But it wouldn't have been it wouldn't have been nesting. It would have been roosting. Terminology alert. Roosting where you sleep. Nesting where you have babies. Mm. And if you see a blackbird and you're not sure if it's a starling or not, look at the bill. It's always going to be that ivory color. Whereas blackbirds will have black bills.
Okay.
Anyway, digression from gardening. Let's get back to gardening here.
All right, we got all kinds of questions. The weather is lovely. There's lots of things to do in the garden. Very quickly, I will mention that yes, you can still plant lots of vegetables and lots of things can go in. The one thing that we're still putting out fresh is cucumbers and squash and pumpkins and melons, because this is really when you plant them, interestingly. And someone said, cucumbers now, do they have time? Cucumbers planted now will be giving you cucumbers in 4 to 5 weeks. They're one of the fastest things to produce. Zucchini being another good example. So yes, if you've got a little spot in your vegetable garden and your tomatoes are growing fine, but this is what I'm doing right now. There's an emitter over there. There's nothing on that emitter. I think I'll go plant something over there. It'll be winter squash or pumpkin or cucumber. And the cucumbers will happen, you know, very, very quickly. I have had an interesting pest problem that I'm going to mention. It took me a while to figure this out a couple of years ago. Now I know what it is. I planted sunflowers and zinnias and winter squash and pumpkins and watermelons and regular muskmelons all in one area on this huge area of vegetable garden that I have. They're all 6 to 8 feet apart. This is not some sort of chaotic jumble. I have lots of room. And I went out and one of the melons had been methodically eaten off, flattened, and all the foliage had been eaten off. Whatever did that had walked past all of those other things, had walked past zinnia, sunflower, watermelon, and winter melons, and gone around them to lie on this plant and eat all the foliage off muskmelon. Okay, well, that's a one weird thing. I go out the next day, another one. They've gone now past several more zinnias and sunflowers and flattened the plant and eaten all the foliage off just of the muskmelon. And there were three muskmelons planted out there with about 30 plants of all these other different types I've mentioned all around them. Next day, the third one was flattened and all the foliage was eaten off. A couple of years ago, I caught the cottontail in the middle of this process. So I know that this is what rabbits do. Apparently, if you're trying to figure out one, I don't know why they only eat the muskmelons. Maybe they'll move on to the other things now that they've eaten the three muskmelons that were in that planting. But they apparently find it more comfortable to lie on them than the other things. And then while they're lying there, they methodically eat all the leaves off. I'm not sure these three plants are going to resprout. But if you're trying to figure out what is eating your plants, and people come into us all the time, I have these holes, I have this. Look at the holes, look at the nature of the damage. You can pretty well rule out, you know, if it's all the leaves eaten off, that's usually a bigger animal or insect or whatever than, say, an earwig, which tend to make small holes. These are not just big holes. All leaves missing. Well, that tells me it's probably a rodent or something like a rodent. And then, of course, I actually caught them in the act at one point and shooed them away a couple of years ago. So now I know this kind of intermittent damage where they're strangely methodical and thorough. And yet there's a precision to this that sort of baffles me. I never thought of rabbits as being that smart. I went ahead. This is the funny part. I went ahead and stuck in a winter squash in that spot because they didn't seem like them. They went right past that to go lie down on a melon again. So apparently cottontails like to lie on and eat muskmelons. So the first question someone would ask me is, what are you going to do about it? And so I'm going to put a fence up. That's easy. If you're dealing with wildlife, if you're dealing with wildlife problems or doing damage in the garden, this goes for rodents too. I mean, we're having these conversations with people in town about squirrels and rats. You know, what do you do? Literally the only thing you can do, unless you're living in a place where shooting or poisoning is within your wheelhouse. That's not certainly not going to be the case in Davis. You put up a physical barrier. You just make a barrier. And they're like, what do you mean? What do you mean a physical barrier? Make it harder for them to get at the plant. I mean, I could put a ring of wire mesh around these plants, or I could just put a fence off where I know they're coming into the garden. I have turkeys going through the garden periodically. That's not a great thing to have. So I'm going to put up a fence. Yes, they can fly over a fence, but they don't want to. Just make it harder for them. Make it a hassle for them to get at your plants. And that usually works, interestingly. At the moment, it's kind of like, well, you're going to eat the melons. I plant them here. I'll plant melons over there. And I'll just keep planting the things you're not eating here, and we'll just cohabit. I tend to try and coexist with wildlife up to a point.
So when the listeners are thinking, oh, well, there's something eating this and maybe I should exclude it, one of the things to think about is how far away your fence is. Now, in Don's case, he could put a fence, you know, 2 feet around, 2 feet on each side, around whatever it is.
Just a ring.
When the turkeys come and they get there and they see it and they smell it and they know it's there, they're more likely to hop over it. Whereas if he was putting the fence at the edge of the plot, you know, 50 feet away, The turkeys haven't figured out that this good stuff is here yet, so they'll probably just walk along the fence looking for something to eat instead of hopping over.
So I deal with turkeys on a daily basis. There's a flock of 30 to 35 of them, mostly centered on my farm, but also on some of the farms around us. And I don't have a huge problem with them because the damage they basically do is just by walking through. They're just scratching up dirt, taking dust baths. That's not great for a plant if it happens to be there when they do that. They're just going through. Just the size of their feet and their claws is what you're looking at. And the fact that there's so many of them. And they're really cute right now. They have babies. There's a little flock of them with a little baby turkeys going through. Could be more than 30 or 35 this year. Who knows? If I were methodically trying to get rid of them, aside from killing them, which I don't plan to do, I would go out and look for their nests, and just mowing the place usually takes care of that because they're nesting in the grasses. So that's one thing, is to look for the nesting sites. What I have found with turkeys, even a 3-foot fence will redirect them. You know, they come along, they'll just go along the fence until they get to the end. They want to move quickly. They want to stay together. And they're not going in and typically tearing up your garden, eating the plants. They're just poking around, looking for stuff in the soil and finding places to take dust baths. So just redirect them. By comparison, a squirrel or a tree rat is rather more fixated on doing the damage that they do in your garden. But again, physical barriers just slow them down. They don't want to slow down. You know, they want to keep moving and find easy food. So no, it's not. Yes, of course, a squirrel can climb over a fence or crawl under it. A tree rat can get through any hole. But if you just make it a little harder for them, that's the key. And physical barriers become the answer. And typically, this is just wire mesh that you put up. You know, if I wanted to protect these melons to get them established, I would just put a ring of wire mesh around them for 3-4 weeks until they're fully established. And then probably the damage wouldn't occur again, because they'll find a different place to go lie on something and eat all the leaves off. Okay, a little more about wildlife. Anytime you want to have a discussion about wildlife problems in the garden, I'm your guy. I keep hoping the fox will take care of the rabbit problem. All right, we got lots of questions and things to talk about here.
So if you have a multi-trunked olive tree,
yeah,
and one trunk dies, have you overwatered it?
Maybe, but not likely. When you overwater, we hate that term, of course, because it's not precise. It sounds like, oh, I put too many gallons of water on all at once. No, you really can't do that. You've wasted water, perhaps, but it doesn't hurt the tree to have 100 gallons put on it all at once, even if it only needed 5. Overwatering or first watering too often and keeping moisture around the crown of the tree where the interface of the bark and the soil is kept damp during hot weather, and you get an infection from Phytophthora cinnamomi. That's why we say overwatering, because that sentence was too complicated. So overwatering.
But that would take the whole tree.
Not necessarily. It can kill one part of the tree, but that's not the typical pattern. On an olive tree, which otherwise looks healthy, and one whole branch died, either up high on the tree or from the ground level, there's a particular borer. Borers are some of our least favorite insects in the landscape, in the garden and trees, because they can do a lot of damage. 1970s, this borer showed up in California and started attacking raywood ash trees, which had been popular heretofore, and a branch would die, another branch would die. And it also attacks privets, lilacs, and olives. And the pattern is one branch. I had it on one of my lilacs. Lilacs had been on this farm for 50 years before we bought the place, and I've planted more of them. And one branch died, just exactly like being described here with the olive tree. And I found the point of infestation. It's a little hard to spot, but I found the point, and I just cut that whole thing out, and it went away. And it's never happened since. On raywood ash, it tends to keep reinfesting. So if you look at raywood ash trees, there's a bunch of them in the parking lot north of Nugget in North Davis, Nugget Market, if anybody locally wants to see examples. Several branches in any given tree will be dead, but the tree otherwise looks healthy. So the tree folks that manage it, if they did, would come in. They don't there, but if they did, they would come in. They'd prune those all out. They'd take them away, take them off the property to the dump or whatever. Yeah, they could even chip them, because that would certainly kill the borers. And a couple of years will go by and it'll start to happen again. It doesn't kill the tree, but can kind of disfigure it. And the same borer does attack olive trees. So when you have one branch dying like that, go down below the dead part into what appears to be green and healthy, prune that whole thing out. Probably the problem will be solved at that point. It has nothing to do with your watering. It's a particular pest that attacks. Again, olives, privets, no big problem there, lilacs, and raywood ash. So we call that the ash lilac borer, but we probably should also call it the olive privet borer because it also affects them. Olives, privets.
That's boring, Don.
Yes, they're boring. Olives, privets, and lilacs are all closely related. If you happen to be allergic to olives, you're probably allergic to privets as well.
So odd you should mention lilacs because Lucy wrote to us with a question. And hello, Don and Lois. 2 years ago, I wrote the first time asking for some help with my Trombetta squash plants. I shared at that time that my then 3-year-old son would always instantly fall asleep within minutes of turning on the show during our Saturday afternoon drive to Roseville. This has taken a new turn. 2 months ago, he asked to change from his regular sleep cast at night to the Davis Garden Show. This trend has continued. His confidence and trust affirms what I've always felt. I come for the advice, but I stay for the vibe. Oh, that is amazing.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to know that my voice is mellifluous enough to put your kid to sleep. Let me know if you have any requests. I can read Winnie the Pooh if you need it.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. I moved last year. I'm in a rental and inherited a lilac. The lilac has a lovely bloom set last May, but it was looking very rough. I summer pruned it and waited all year, worried I'd pruned it too late for blooms. I saw blooms forming, but I saw only a few flowers. I'm not sure if they're suffering from frost or fungus or what. I've attached photos from a few weeks ago. What are your thoughts?
Okay.
The picture she sent is just really, it's amazing. There's this one branch that's all dead and crusty and yucky.
Yeah, that would be the typical pattern for this particular borer that we get here. Now, I don't know the location on this, but it was a drive in the valley somewhere. So it's possible that that there is this ash lilac borer affecting the plant, in which case you prune out the whole branch. There are a couple bacterial diseases that occasionally hit lilacs, not commonly out here in the West. I believe they're more of a problem in the rainier summer climates. I would make one note about, first of all, lilac is a common name as well as an actual plant. We use the term to refer to Ceanothus, for example, which is California lilac. But here, the picture, thank you, is Syringa, the actual French hybrid lilac, the classic one that most people are thinking of when they're growing lilacs for the wonderful fragrance and all that kind of thing. They set their flower buds in the late summer. They initiate flower bud production late summer, early fall. And if you prune in the late summer, unfortunately, you may have removed a fair bit of the next season's bloom. So the typical time that we prune lilacs here is after the bloom. We let them bloom in the spring, which in our area is typically April, May. Or as one of mine starts in late March, typically April, and some as late as May. And then you prune them if you need to. And the only reason you would need to is for size control. So if it's, you know, mine had gotten 10, 12 feet at when we first bought the place, they were 10, 12 feet tall and had never been pruned. So we went ahead, waited till they bloomed, cut them back 50%. That was pretty extreme, but we're trying to get them back more or less at eye level. You don't have to prune them at all, but they'll get big and you'll have trouble reaching the flowers to enjoy the fragrance. So pruning would be primarily for size control. In rainier climates, I would assume they probably thin them out a little bit for better airflow to reduce mildew, which can be a problem on them, and some other disease problems. This might be a bacterial disease, but more likely it looks like one branch has been affected and possibly by the ash lilac borer. So they're done blooming for now. The season, you know, bloom season is certainly over by June. I would prune out the portion that is blackened and dying back completely, take that away, send it out with your trash or whatever you do, wherever you're listening. And probably that'll solve the problem. Lilacs are not fussy at all. I found them surprisingly drought tolerant on my property, but they look better if I give them their own occasional deep watering. They don't need any spraying here. None of the fungus problems that they get in other places are really an issue here. And they don't need any special fertilizer. In the East Coast, I'm told, they lime their lilacs. Every now and then someone will walk in and say to me, is it time to lime my lilacs? My staff looks very confused. And I say,
we don't need to lime our soils at all here.
Our water has enough lime in it to take care of that problem. Yes, they would actually go to nurseries, I'm told, and look for lime, oyster shell lime or any of a number of hydrated lime, whatever is available in your area, because the pH where you're listening east of the Mississippi River would be too low for lilacs to prosper. So they actually prefer a somewhat more alkaline condition. Well, that's what we have here. So this is one of the few plants that actually appreciates our water. So you don't need to worry about that. No special fertilizer needed. Doesn't hurt to feed them if you want them to grow faster. Any kind of nitrogen or rose food or whatever you have on hand will be fine. I've never fertilized my lilacs, but if you want to, that's absolutely fine. Deep watering, some pruning for size control. Other than that, they're very carefree. And people are often surprised to learn that they grow here in California because they think of them much more of an East Coast or Northern tier states or Canada, you know, where lilacs do very, very well. They do very well out here. Where you're listening will determine which kind you buy. A slight digression here. If you're in Southern California, for example, where the winters are milder, they do need chilling to bloom well. In Southern California, the Descanso hybrids were introduced many, many years ago by Descanso Gardens down there. And they are ones that will grow and bloom with only a couple hundred chilling hours. So you don't absolutely have to have the kind of winter we get here for them to bloom. They do well up here as well. They don't need to be in a low chill area. They'll do very well in Northern California as well. They're fragrant, although you really want a fragrant lilac, look for the regular old-fashioned French hybrid. Full sun is best. In the shade, they tend to get powdery mildew. They still bloom even if they get powdery mildew. But I think what you're seeing there could be a borer affecting one part of the plant. I would prune it out completely. Anything that's blackened and dyed back looks like it should be pruned out, and right now would be a good time to do that. Then just take all that away. And then if you want to restore their vigor, give them their own deep soaking every now and then. And if you want to feed them, absolutely fine to get more growth on them this season.
So if listeners are not familiar with lilacs, if you haven't grown them, it has an interesting inflorescence, the pattern of flowering. The flowers come out, poof, and they're near the tips of the plant. Near the ends of the plant. When the season's over and that flower has finished, it will set seed or not set seed, whatever. Yeah. But that growing area where the flower was is now going to get brown and crunchy. It's going to die back. And below it will come out from the side two new buds, which next year will come out and have two lilac flowers from them. So if you are the kind of person who likes to deadhead, you can do that and cut off the little dry parts. And if you accidentally cut further down the plant, it doesn't matter because wherever you cut, the next buds below that will come out and make flowers.
It doesn't matter if you do it right after they bloom. It does matter if you do it in August or September because you're cutting off the flower buds that have initiated for the next year. And deadheading is not necessary. It's strictly aesthetic. This is not with roses, for example, they'll say you need to deadhead so the energy goes into the new growth, new bloom. It's not going to happen on lilacs. So you do it because you don't like the appearance.
So the other point of this is not because it's ugly, which it's not. I mean, it just turns brown and crumbles away. But if you want to enjoy them all the time, you're not going to grow a foot every year. I'm not going to get 6, 7, 8
Oh, as I said, no, ours are 10 to 12 feet tall.
Flowers down where I am.
Yeah. So that's the only one. Yeah.
Feel free to trim them right after they're done blooming and trim them down if you want them to get be lower.
Yeah, size control being the primary reason. Now, I did mention the Descanso hybrids do well here. I do have one I'm actually about to take out because it blooms every fall. And you might think, oh, how cool, your lilac blooms in the fall. No, it looks weird and it bothers me. So it's a Descanso hybrid. Apparently, after it's initiated the blooms in the late summer, August, September, it doesn't need any chilling to bloom, and it blooms in October. And again, I don't think of that as being particularly desirable. I don't know which variety it is. It's a white one. The Descanso
Does it smell hybrid, good?
It's okay. The Descanso hybrids are not as fragrant as the French hybrids, so I'm going to dig that one out and put in a French hybrid. But if you're listening in Southern California, I remember as an avid gardener when I was a teenager in coastal San Diego, one of our neighbors had a lilac. This is not, you don't see lilacs and flowering quince and spireas and forsythias and things like that in coastal San Diego. They don't usually get the chilling that they need, but they had one and they informed me, this is anecdotal, folks, that they would mulch it with ice cubes to get it to bloom.
I've done that.
It did. It bloomed. So I don't know whether, I'm guessing they had a Descanso hybrid that would have bloomed anyway, but it's quite possible that mulching with ice cubes will stimulate bloom on lilacs in coastal Southern California. Sample size N equals one. Anecdotal results, your mileage may vary.
Oh, I heard that when I moved in here, and there was a lilac out there, and it was right on the street, and I thought, well, okay, we'll try it,
The
and I
point
iced it, and it worked.
the
But
point
then
is
I
here,
stopped icing it, and it still bloomed just fine.
you don't need to do that here. They
You don't
bloom
need to do that.
anyway.
I
So,
did it. It
yeah.
worked. So this leads me to the next thing for people to think about. When anybody says to you, I had, for example, peach leaf curl, and I did this thing, and the peach leaf curl went away. The next leaves were just fine. Okay, so whether they're talking about putting coffee grounds on it or going out and dancing naked under the tree or whatever else they're going to do to use to change things, you know, it would have fixed itself anyway.
Probably, yes.
So be leery is what I'm trying to say.
So if you're going to construct an experiment, you need to cover all the bases and you need to know what the actual life cycle of the organism or the pest is, because very likely what you've done is just you timed something at the time the disease or pest is ending. So we see this
That's
kind
what
of thing
the
all
ice cube thing was.
Yeah, we see this kind of thing all the time. I did this. My grandma always put a not mine, but someone will say, oh, my grandma always put a Tums tablet under the tomato plant and the blossom end rot went away. It was going to go away anyway. So if you want to actually do a controlled study, you know, you do a double blind study with lots of replications and you factor in all those different variables. That's not usually done. Most of what you're seeing on these YouTube videos and stuff is anecdotal. And when I read it with my gimlet eye, as someone with, you know, plant physiology and soil science training and plant pathology training, I'm going, none of this makes sense from the standpoint of any of that. That doesn't mean it's not valid. That just means that this was not an actual experiment. So it's fine to do these things at home. Certainly try your own, be your own scientist. That's absolutely cool. And then consider that the starting point for learning more about the actual pathogen or the actual life cycle or the actual bloom cycle of the plant. YouTube videos are fun. Someone sent us a great one. It was very entertaining to watch. We could go
but it
through.
Was wrong.
We could go through an entire show of these kinds of things, and I, you know, watch them up to a point. I really wish that there was a summary that would just say this guy used Epsom salts, and this is the outcome he thinks he saw. Because I don't need to go through 10 minutes to see that. Some of those I know the answer already. Others would be interesting. I know a very avid fruit tree grower. He's in the Woodland Davis area, and he makes his own special concoction for spraying to prevent peach leaf curl. And he posts it every year on Facebook, and I've read it, and he sprays it as the tree is pushing out and showing leaf curl. And look, the tree grows out of the leaf curl. And so there's the correlation of his having sprayed is cured the peach leaf curl. When in point of fact, what he's never done is I sprayed this tree and not this tree. To see what the results were, if they compared in any way. And you have to do that rather carefully. They got to be the same variety because varieties differ with respect to their susceptibility to peach leaf curl. You've got to look at the location and so forth. He tells his friends to make this concoction. It's a home remedy, so I'm not going to repeat it because we don't delve into home remedies here. But it's he's making a correlation that isn't valid in terms of actually functioning in your yard. Harmless. Fine. I have no problem with it. There's many of those things that I do have problems with because they're actually recommending things that could be harmful in some way. So back to our basic dictum. Is it necessary? Is it harmful? If it's neither of the above, knock yourself out.
So our listener Lucy writes, hello, Don and Lois. My neighbor shared her frustration with the condition of her lawn. I repeated your information about mowing higher to self-shade the roots. No, that's not quite. Anyway, to make it work better. She was dubious, but has given it a try, and it looks much healthier now. So thank you. So is mowing higher to self-shade the roots? I thought it was the growing point.
Well, the roots and the growing point. Basically, okay. The denser your lawn, the healthier the individual plants will be, the likelier they are to get through a hot spell, a dry, windy spell. Open soil is the enemy of a healthy lawn because it allows weeds to come in. If we do have, when we have a dry north wind here, the humidity in Davis is 10%, comparable to what you're getting down in the desert areas. And that with a plant that has a shallow root system that's exposed, many of the roots will be injured by that. If you mulch, you can mulch lawns. It actually is not an unreasonable thing to do to spread compost over open, thin areas of your turf. If you mulch going into high temperature or dry, windy spells like the Santa Ana winds of Southern California, the northern wind, the winds that we get here, that can help. That can actually protect the roots by shading them. And it also can provide a little more moisture around the growing point of the plant. Having The grass shading the soil reduces weeds and helps it get through hot, dry, windy periods much better here in California. So you can, again, you can take a bag of compost and rake that into a thin area if you want to. It's a good time to scatter some seed if you're doing that. But more to the point, you're sheltering, shading, protecting the plants that are there. Mowing higher, it makes a big difference. Not mowing right before a heat wave makes a big difference. And the particular group of grasses that we're most concerned about is the fescues. We've mentioned this several times because it's their most grasses, grass mixes that you're using here in the Sacramento Valley and in interior Southern California, pretty much throughout California now, are fescue blends. There may be something else in there like perennial ryegrass or even some bluegrass for different reasons, even sometimes some bent grass, but the grass is predominantly going to be either one of the wider bladed fescues, such as tall or dwarf fescue, or some of the finer bladed fescues, such as creeping red or chewings or hard fescue. These are our tough, successful grasses, but they are bad. They have a high growing point, so they're badly stressed if you mow them right before high temperatures, meaning anything mid-90s and above, right before low humidity, meaning when the north wind is blowing. So timing, you know, if your kid wants to get out of mowing the lawn and it's going to be in the 90s, give them a break. Tell them they can wait until it's cooler, but they got to do it then, all right? So they can delay, but not forever. Procrastination is an approved horticultural strategy in many cases.
Especially if you have children.
Yeah, you can hang out. You don't have to do it this weekend. Next weekend will be fine if the weather permits.
Yeah. I think the biggest thing about lawns, the biggest lesson that I've learned in the 20 years we've been doing what we've been doing is raise your lawnmower blades. Yeah. Try and keep your lawn lowest at 3 inches. And then let it grow a little and grow, you know, mow it down to 3 inches again.
A lot of lawnmowers can't be sent that high, you know. And yeah. So we had one listener mention that they had finally, when they traded in their mower, they went and got one that allowed them to mow the turf higher. If you look at city parks, you know, first thing I do when I'm strolling through a city park is I get down and I look at the lawn and see what the species are and how they're mowing it and all that kind of thing. This is why I know people don't take me places. And, and so I was looking at a turf in North Davis shortly after they'd mowed it, and I measured it. They were mowing it 4 inches. Now that's a riding mower if you're doing that. You can't usually do that with a typical house, you know, residential lawnmower. But it was a mix of Bermuda grass, lots of fescue, which had been planted originally. There was the Bermuda grass had probably come in on its own, but the city has no reason to care about that particularly. There was some perennial ryegrass, which is often sowed in as we go into the winter because it helps to fill in. There was some clover, which in years past, they probably would have carefully sprayed to kill it out. Now they just let it grow. Clover is fine, stains clothing and draws bees. So, you know, if you're out there with your kids, be aware of that, but it's not everywhere. It's not in the entire lawn. There's really nothing wrong with it in turf. So city lawns are a good example in a well-managed city park system of what is going to be your best blend, because it's what they've come down to by default in the city parks. And they will seed in with certain species, but others will find their way in. And they don't go to the effort to make it a picture perfect lawn, because these are use lawns. They're lawns that are intended for traffic, intended for sports, intended for people to walk on, and they mow them about 4 inches. You probably can't do that, but the one thing would be mow it as high as you can, and don't mow, especially short, right before high temperatures and dry, windy spells.
So, Don, you know, I grew up back in the Midwest, and there was a plant there that I really loved, and I would love to plant here, but I'm not sure what it is. It's a spring blooming plant. We used to call it bridal's wreath. And it's not terribly big, but it has these gorgeous flowers. The ones I had were white, but I've seen pink ones and red ones. Inflorescences as fans. No, is that, that's not the right word. Sort of like yarrow, but a bush. What is it?
Bridal wreath usually refers to spirea.
That's it.
Lots spirea, of different kinds of spirea. Yeah. Spireas do very well here. The one you're referring to that's most commonly called spirea is either Spirea vanhoosii or Spirea prunifolia, I think is the other one. These are 5 to 6 foot tall, 5 to 6 foot across, mounding growth habit, really nice informal growth habit, which for whatever reason are very commonly planted and then clipped as hedges. I don't know why the spirea
It's
band.
because they're planting them too close to the sidewalk.
Well, they do them intentionally. They plant. It is sold and planted as a hedge, and they're usually planted 3 foot apart and clipped as like as if they were boxwood. Which now you have a plant that has a lovely arching informal growth habit, being clipped into geometric forms is one of
No.
my major pet peeves as a horticulturist. It would be really nice if you either choose a plant that you don't have to prune, so you can allow it to have a natural growth habit. Or maybe let them grow more naturally. Spirea van Houttei is still popular, although it's bigger than most of the more modern spireas that have come on the market. There are low growing forms of Spirea bumalda, for example. Anthony Waterer only gets about 3 feet tall, and it blooms on through the summer. So that's a big difference. And it's got pink flowers. So hey, you've got a pink flowered spirea. There's a bunch of Japanese spireas that have become very popular, Spirea nipponica and a couple of others, which are, again, 3 foot, 4 foot range and tighter growth habits. So, hey, if you're doing a hedge, why not use one of them so you don't have to prune it into geometric shape all the time? But really, the old-fashioned one, Spirea van Houttei, which is a hybrid, is one of the most beautiful landscape plants if you can give it a full 6 feet of space. And I really, this is, I would like to drive home maybe 15 points at the Davis Garden Show. Well, this is one I'd really like to get into people's heads when you're looking at landscape designs, when you're watching landscape contractors. Woody shrubs can be allowed to grow naturally, and they can be beautiful landscape plants. And
just
most,
put them back from the sidewalk.
Give them enough room, right? So if you're planting Spirea van Houttei and you're mixing it with Abelia grandiflora, and you've got a Weigelia over there, and you've got some other evergreen things like, I don't know, Raphiolepis or something, mix them, but give each one enough room to grow to its full potential. Do seasonal pruning on them for size control if you need to, but mostly just for shape and to remove dead wood and things like that. There's many roses that fit beautifully in that kind of a combination that could be allowed to grow unpruned. That's a tough one. I've used roses in commercial landscaping and in, you know, like a retirement community, and the gardeners all come in and prune them back hard in January, no matter what we say. They prune them as if they're hybrid tea roses. They can fit in, you know, the shrub roses, the informal ones can fit into this kind of a grouping as well. If you want a good rule of thumb, give each one of those plants 6 feet of space at least. And if you need to get in around them, like you're doing this on, say, a city property or something like that, give them 8 to 10 feet of space so they can get in all around them and you can enjoy that plant to its full potential. Let's do less pruning on these woody shrubs that are trying to give us a season of bloom. And one that really drives me nuts, Spirea is a good example, flowering quince. A lovely plant with an informal sort of irregular growth habit, spectacular bloom in the late mid to late winter, and you know, one of the really showy plants in our region. And then people prune them into geometric shapes. It's an abomination, and you need to stop doing it. Okay. If you want to prune something into a geometric shape, plant a boxwood. That's what they're designed for. And I'll say
that's why
one
they're
thing.
Called box.
I have a row of boxwood where I planted them 8 years ago and I've never pruned them. You know what's a beautiful plant? An unpruned boxwood. Most of you have never seen one. So, rant over.
Rant over. Okay. So, Spirea, could it thrive on just morning sun?
Yes, they'll be fine with that.
No afternoon sun or anything.
Yeah.
Just
yep.
Just light, but not sun.
Yes.
Okay. And then the same question for the oak hydrangea.
Oh, yes, that's a great choice. Oak leaf hydrangea is of the thousands of hydrangea varieties that are apparently in the nursery market at this point. Hydrangea quercifolia is one of my favorites, and there's only a couple cultivars of that in the trade. It's a big plant. Give it room. It gets 6 to 8 feet and equal spread if you allow it to. Excuse me. You can prune it back right after the bloom if you wish to for size control. You can prune it harder in the winter if you have some need to bring it down. But if you need a shorter hydrangea quercifolia, there is a more compact version on the market as well. Other than that, it's basically the same plant. You know what's really cool about this plant, aside from the fact that it has this really lovely bloom that's just finishing up now, and some people like the way the blooms fade to a sort of a buff tan color, and so they'll often leave them. You're welcome to deadhead it if you like. The foliage turns color in November, and it's bright red. It's quite beautiful, and it hangs on all the way through December. So this is a plant with multiple season characteristics that is a nice background plant. We have one right up front at our nursery, and it's been in a place where we can completely control the irrigation. It's in the flower bed, but there's just a line going to it. There have been years where we've just watered it every couple weeks. a very deep soaking, it's done fine. And it only gets morning sun, afternoon shade. Other times it's, we've upped the watering there, so it's getting the same thing as all the flowers out front. Oh, it loves that. It flourishes. It does very well as well. But compared to every other hydrangea that I'm aware of, it's definitely more drought tolerant and definitely a more attractive landscape plant. Hydrangea macrophylla, grandma's hydrangea, as I always call it, mophead hydrangea is the common name for that one. That's one you're all thinking of, and they're giant flowers, and they're really showy, gaudy is the term I would use. They're fine, but if they go even a little bit too dry, the leaves burn. They wither on the edges. They're not really a great plant for the valley. You need tons of water. No, hydrangea quercifolia is a great alternative.
I'm thinking that I will take those two, the spirea and the oak leaf hydrangea, and put them back from the sidewalk.
Yes, yes please.
in my front yard to try and block the passage so that people don't think, oh, well, I'll walk through here. Right. And so I'm thinking about that. So I should probably plant those in the fall to take advantage of the winter rains.
Sure. Fall is a great time to plant. Yeah. If you plant them in the summer, of course, you need to water carefully as they're getting established. Fall is a great time here. October is an ideal month for that. And give each of those plants 6-foot diameter. So if you're near a sidewalk, especially because you don't want to get into code compliance issues, 6 feet back would be great. And they would be a great combination because of the slightly differing growth habits. As you're looking at a lot of these flowering shrubs, one of my favorite growth habits for a deciduous flowering shrub is that kind of arching informal growth habit that the spireas have. It can really make a spectacular showcase when it's in bloom. And then the hydrangeas is a bit more upright and rounded. So just keep that in mind as you locate them, but they'd be a great combination. Bear in mind, you're going to see through them both in the winter because they're both deciduous. So you might wish to sneak in an evergreen, I don't know, a boxwood or something right along the sidewalk.
Oh, I'll have to think about that. Yeah.
But here's the thing.
I thought that the spirea lost its leaves.
It does, although it's twiggy. You know, there's still something there. It's not like it's completely barren because it's got a dense twiggy growth habit. And the hydrangea holds its leaves, in my experience, all the way through December and then leafs out again in February. So it's not like you're looking at a bleak landscape. But I would think a little flowering quince could be added to that combination. You know, I know it's deciduous.
Are they evergreen?
No, but they bloom starting in January. So quince, hydrangea quercifolia, spirea, you've got your front. There you go.
Yeah. And the thing with this is that I am not going to be able to walk out in the middle of this stuff anymore. Mm-hmm. So it's going to have to be watered and left alone.
Yeah. These are plants that could have a good soaking once a week, typically, and they'd be absolutely fine with that. So,
well, let's see what else we've got. Oh, this is an interesting message. This one is from Ben. And Ben is a frequent listener.
Yep.
Contributor, yeah. And okay, we'll take this one paragraph at a time. Dear Don and Lois, it is no exaggeration to say that your discussion on the basics of watering your plants has saved a life. Actually, multiple lives. I was actively killing a beautiful little white sapote tree until I realized that I was not watering close enough to the very narrow root ball. I had gotten it partially root bound in a tall but narrow pot. And I swear I was checking the soil and the soil was moist, but where the roots were was dry as a bone.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and I've run into this myself. I'm establishing some citrus trees, you know, interplanting some, and the drip system is watering the zone, but not past them. In fact, in one case, the tree was looking, you know, walking by, I could see it was looking a little drooped, and I knew I'd just run the system, and I went over. Yes, the emitter was doing what it was supposed to, but it was only covering about half of the root zone. So I just adopted, there's a hose out there, I just adopted a habit of hand watering the younger trees that I just put in, standing there watering the nursery soil, but also then doing a donut thing, you know, going around the tree for only 15 or 20 seconds, but with one of those soft rain nozzles to water out past, and they promptly perk back up. I did also add another emitter, but it's really important to check daily and water as needed. I think I've heard that somewhere.
It's a good quote. You know, we should use that on the show. Okay, Ben continues. I have a question about planting California natives. The Theodore Payne Foundation's guidance for planting suggests digging a hole 3 times the diameter of the pot and filling it thrice fold with water so that the ground is well saturated before planting. What does that mean? Filling it thrice fold with water.
Three times, yes. Good.
So you fill it, let it drain, fill it, let it drain?
Yeah, I've heard this many times. I know lots of people who, when they plant a tree, dig the hole, partially fill the hole with water before they continue the process. I don't personally do that, but the idea is that you're getting moisture down below the root zone of the new tree. I have no problem with this, but it's not absolutely necessary. They're just concerned, probably based on experience, that people aren't going to water enough, thoroughly enough after they plant. But there's nothing wrong with this approach in general. However, go ahead.
And it also depends on where your what your soil is like, whether or not this is more useful or less. Yeah. Okay, where are we going? This has the added benefit of encouraging deep root growth. I have noticed that the sides of the hole tend to develop that irksome sheen that you all have warned may occur when you try to plant too soon after a rainstorm that saturates the soil. For context, I have heavy, mostly clay loam.
Yeah.
Okay, so my first question is whether I should be concerned about the hole wall issue. And perhaps this is not the same as digging a hole in diffusely waterlogged soil.
Mm-hmm.
After that, I turn to the question of how to facilitate healthy root growth through and beyond the hole. I am tempted to just come back a while later and just stab a spade in the ground, orientating radially to the tree when the soil is dry. What? But I'm also wondering if you think about just planting annuals or cover crop with good roots and watering. Now, wait a minute. I didn't understand that part.
Okay.
I'm going to come back later and stab a spade in the ground oriented radially to the tree when the soil is dry.
So digging a hole and filling it up with water does cause some crusting over of the surface and can temporarily obstruct the ability of fine root hairs to penetrate outward. I'm concerned when someone would order a tree from us and they'll order it and I'll say, yeah, it'll be here in, you know, about 2 weeks. Good. I'll go home and dig the hole. And I'm thinking, why don't you, hold on here. Don't dig the hole until you're ready to plant the tree. Because indeed with clay loam soils, it can crust over. And I would do exactly what he's describing when I've had that situation where you go ahead and break up that sheen, that crusted over side of the hole, before putting the new tree in. I don't think it's a great idea to dig the hole well ahead of time. And I don't really personally ever bother with this fill the hole and let it drain thing. But I've had people on my landscape staff who were trained to do that. It seems to work fine. I would plant right away. I would dig a hole and plant right away personally. And if you have done this where they're recommending it and you're going back and finding it seems sealed over, yes, breaking up the side of the hole is something I've actually done. I've done exactly what he's describing, just kind of breaking through that now sealed over clay loam soil. This is a clay loam soil issue. It's not a problem in sandy loams or soils that have a whole lot of organic material. But we have areas of clay loam or silty loam, in my case, on my farm, which crusts back over. Row crop farmers know this, that the soil will get a density that makes it harder for seedlings to push through. So they'll often cultivate again right before, you know, drilling in the seeds. So it is a reasonable concern. I haven't seen tons of research on this, but I do have that concern that you've possibly made something that'll make it difficult for those fine hairs to push outward, at least for a little while. There's other ways to possibly deal with that. And it starts with the, but I'm also wondering part of the comment.
Well, first, you're saying break up the edges as you're planting. Mm-hmm. Keep saying, wait till the soil's dry and do it later.
We're all saying the same thing. We're saying the same thing.
Okay, good. All right. I'm wondering what you think about planting annuals or a cover crop with good roots at watering.
Yeah.
Poppies, this unpronounceable name. What is that?
Diterondamon capitatus. You can look it up.
Okay. What is it?
It's an annual flowering native wildflower.
So, anything that might work this late in the season, this letter is the end of May. And any guesstimate at how long it would take those roots to break down the soil compaction barrier?
They do it right away. If it's a tap-rooted plant, poppies would be a good example. Many non-native plants, like mustard, will do it. It's actually used as a cover crop, even though it's one of the most invasive plants in California, makes a tap-rooted plant. These are not things you'd be planting at the beginning of the summer. People have been coming in occasionally asking for summer cover crops, and those would generally not be native plants. I have seen this done effectively with buckwheat, for example. Buckwheat, not the shrubby buckwheat, not Eriogonum, but the kind that's grown for the grain, as the summer planted cover crop. Cowpeas are the other summer planted cover crop. Those are the two main ones that are used. Buckwheat that's scattered in early June to mid-June will come up in a matter of 3 to 5 days, grow very rapidly, develops fast growing roots, and just be sure to mow it off before it goes to seed, or else you'll have buckwheat everywhere. But it actually works very well, and it does exactly what you're describing. The roots grow quickly. You're watering, which makes a difference right there, and you're getting a lot of vegetative stuff on top, your biomass, to allow to be used as a surface mulch when you mow it. And typically mowing buckwheat takes care of it. So you can plant it and it'll come up very quickly. You'll get a cover, you mow, you turn some of it in as you're planting, just because that's what happens. And you've basically helped break up the soil with the roots and added organic material on the surface. The cowpeas are a little more complicated. They're deeper rooted. Most people know black-eyed peas. They're a type of cowpea. Crowder peas are another type. Tap rooted, but the plant runs out across the ground, much as bur clover does. So it gets a bit more of a tangle when you're trying to use it as a cover crop, but it does work. You generally have to hoe that one off. And it makes an edible thing. You know, you can eat cowpeas and black-eyed peas. Those are the two main summer cover crops, neither of them native, but they would do the job. I would just go ahead and break up that barrier and then mulch around the tree, water correctly, and the roots will get through. But I do have concerns about digging early, especially in heavier soils, creating this barrier that you'll have. It is best if you can break it up somehow. And I think what Ben is describing is exactly the way to do it, just mechanically break it up.
Anything else from this that you wanted to talk about?
There is a great link on using native plants for cover crops, and that is done in the vineyards, for example, up here in wine country. You'll see them do this, where they'll seed in California native flowering plants instead of the more conventional cover crops. The conventional cover crops are clovers and vetches and things like that. And they're actually using a whole bunch of native plants carefully chosen, sometimes with annual grasses and so forth. There's been a lot of research on this. Phacelia is a good example of one that they're using. Many of these are plants that bring in beneficials when they're in bloom. They make great cover for wildlife and for beneficial insects. This is a UCANR, one of our favorite websites. It's simply go in there, ucanr.edu, and do a search for green blog, and up will come an article: can California native plants be used as cover crops to benefit farmers and native ecosystems? And the answer is yes.
So we usually end our shows with a garden quote, and this time I have one that Don found, and it says, "You don't have to be good at gardening for gardening to be good for you."
Yeah. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.